Trauma is a complex topic that looks differently in everybody's life. And joining me on the show today is Taylor Millsap. Taylor is an occupational therapist who has experienced trauma within her own life and now has a passion to help clients and practitioners be more mindful of the influence trauma can have on our lives.
If you're interested in occupational therapy, this is the place for you. This show aims to explore our profession by sharing who we are and what we do. Because for us, occupational therapy is more than just a job. Hi, I'm Sarah. Welcome to OT for Life.
Hey, Taylor, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to have you on today.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. It's been so long. This is amazing. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I think we're going to dive into all things trauma today. And I know like over the past couple years, trauma-informed care has been pretty much a hot topic within our profession. And there's been lots and lots of stuff being said about it. But I feel like now more than ever, we need to continue having conversations and really dive in deep to what trauma is and how it can affect everybody. And so I want to start by just kind of going back in time a little bit and going back to that moment, the pivotal moment that really stands out to you in your life in regards to trauma.
Well, when I go back, I was about 12 years old. And looking back at my childhood, I would say that up until this point, I thought I was super happy, healthy, protected, in a happy home. And then I got good grades on something and I earned a black light in my room. It was all the rage those days. And it was put up and this person came in and helped me. And I was like, come see this, come see this. And then we turned on the black light and turned off the lights. And the person who used to be my safety looked down at the floor and then looked back up at me very slowly. And I saw their eyes were these black holes. Their hair had neon green, wavy highlights. And then they kind of looked up at me over their eyebrows and did a big smile. And it was just green and glowing. And in that moment, I remember thinking, this is what this person really is. This is this person's true color. And I screamed uncontrollably, get out. And they looked at me and were like, what are you talking about, sweetie? Oh, it's all in your head. There's nothing wrong. Oh my goodness, your imagination's getting away with you. And I was just like, get out, get out, get out. They left and I was in hysterics. And that's when I knew that my house wasn't safe, that I wasn't safe, and that it was a fallacy. And what was happening, and I had been emotional at times, and I was seen as the A-plus student, the really good teacher's pet, amazing student, and would come home and would have an attitude problem, which I thought I was just like, well, you know, whatever. Like, that's just what you do. But I realized there was something deeper inside that was triggering that. And it made me wake up. I had realized that I had been a victim of physical abuse, emotional abuse, a lot of psychological manipulation, and that I was told that I was crazy and I was imagining those things. And I believed it. And it took an image in a black light for me to realize what had actually been happening. And it was terrifying.
How long do you feel like this had been going on? I know it's probably hard to go back and remember specifically, but like, if you can kind of put yourself back in that moment when you had that reflection and that kind of like wake up call, how long do you actually think it had been going on?
So when I look back, I used to say about 10 years old. On my 10th birthday, I remember the day after I left a cup on the table and didn't put it in the dishwasher. And I got this huge reaction, just screaming about how horrible I am, how irresponsible I am. And just, it scared me. It was very loud and very daunting. And now when I look back, I really think it's been even longer. I think it's been years and my brain has been protecting itself. So there is that one moment that stands out right after my 10th birthday that I remember but I believe it's even longer than that.
Yeah. And I feel like especially when we are younger, we don't necessarily, we're just trying to make sense of the world and just trying to make sense of everything that's going on. So there's probably a very good chance that there was other stuff happening that you just either attributed to being normal or talked yourself into, oh, this is just how it is. Oh, it's me. Oh, it, like just kind of like enter any excuse into this is not a negative thing. This is my life. This is what I'm going through and this is my normal.
Well, and you don't want to believe that the person who's supposed to love you actually doesn't treat you like it and is supposed to be your safe place and is the farthest thing from that. As a child, just like those complex emotions are so hard for us to grasp that when those things happen, you don't want to believe it. And even adults, like when something so big happens that is so scary, the first reaction and protective mechanism is denial. And I truly was in denial for many, many years. Though looking back, I was always really protective of my brothers and I never fully understood why. And I think it was because I knew what was going on and I did not want them to be victim of anything happening. I was going to be their safety net and I was going to protect them, even if that meant me taking all of the blame and all of the hit and really just being there for my family.
Yeah, that was probably definitely your protective mechanism for yourself to say, I'm not going to deal with this. I'm going to protect everybody else from it, but then not realizing the impact that it was having on you and your mentality and your physical and mental health and everything like that.
Absolutely.
And then what you kind of mentioned right in the beginning is that you were also like a really good student and wanted to do well and wanted to please people. And so I'm sure that there were a lot of these kind of different assumptions that were made about you, about maybe that you were just trying too hard or that you were seeking attention or something like that. As this was all going on, as you're trying to sort this out in your mind and in your home, and then there's a bunch of other assumptions that are being made around you from people at school or friends or probably other family members.
Yes, 100%. And I wanted to maintain that perfect image. And I think that one, I got so much praise for being the great student. I got so much love and attention that I've realized looking back that I was looking for because I felt so disconnected from and I didn't truly receive. And one thing for me is that my mother gave me that and my mom was that for me, but there was still a hole and there was still this feeling that if those people who are supposed to love me and care for me see me and don't like me and really abuse me, what does that mean for me? Why should I love me if the people who know me the most and are supposed to love me don't actually care about me and instead hurt me a lot? And I looked to my teachers. That was the thing. That was my identity at that point, the good student, the really good girl. So I did everything in my power, even until late in my teenage years, to be the good girl. And it was really hard to maintain. And being the good girl and the perfect image is also making sure that none of this ever got out. So even though I realized what was happening, I didn't want anyone else to know. And I was going to be in control of the story. And I was going to say, this isn't actually happening. But it was.
Looking back, do you think, like maybe specifically teachers or a close outsider, not necessarily family, but a close outsider, do you think somebody knew?
No. It wasn't until my sophomore year of high school that I think people started seeing it. Even my childhood best friend, since I was 5 years old, who had been in the house, who had interacted with that person so regularly. The thing about chronic abusers, they're really good at hiding their true selves. So much so that you don't think what you actually saw happened. And I, looking back, I saw signs of that person to me being inappropriate and, you know, probably other things that had happened and gone on. And I do know that there was a history of abuse in that person's life too. Their father, so I was told by them, beat them. And it's a cycle. And when I look back, I don't think anyone truly knew, like even my childhood best friend. I finally started talking about it when I was 15. Even when I said that, my best friend was like, "What are you talking about? They're so nice. Like, are you sure?" I was like, yes, I'm sure. And at this point, it had gone on for so long that I was in hysterics when it finally came out. So I was so emotional. People are just like, oh, like they just like wrote that off as like, you're too emotional. You're not thinking logically. And so I had all this pent up for so long. And then when it eventually came out, it took a while of like, no, this is happening, for people to be like, oh.
Yeah. And I can see it being like, oh, you're emotional. Oh, you're a woman. That's a typical woman thing. We're too emotional. Or that's just Taylor. That's just what she does. And I think that just ties into that psychological manipulation where the abuser is causing the psychological manipulation. But then you and your brain are also trying to make sense of what's going on, and also probably creating some tension as well, where you're like, maybe it wasn't as bad, or maybe I am overreacting, or like where you're basically trying to talk yourself out of all the bad stuff that is happening.
Every second of every day of my childhood, I did that. I tried to put the blame on myself. And the phenomenon that you're talking about when people deny in the reality is called gaslighting. And it's something that's been talked about a lot. And it's basically what's happening. People are denying the realities. So like if something happened, like for instance, even in this world right now, people are saying, oh no, what are you talking about? The sky isn't clearer. No, it's fine. You're just, you know, the sky is actually clearer right now. But people are trying to protect that image. And so people doubt themselves. When your reality is questioned, you're like, did I really see that? And then you just go down this hole. And if the outcome that you want is the one being told is not happening, then you're like, oh yeah, well, okay, I can believe that then. And it's just this cycle that is so damaging. And I think the hardest thing to break out of in regard to emotional manipulation, I mean, that I think to this day is the hardest thing that I've had to overcome, was understanding my own reality and know I'm actually seeing things correctly. And it's time to fight for myself because this is actually happening. And I kept thinking in my mind, well, crazy people don't think they're crazy, so maybe I am. Like that was my mindset over and over and over and over. And though I don't love that word crazy, that's how it was posed to me. And it was really hard for me to get that reality straight.
And I'm sure too, you probably have other people that you look up to, whether they are family members, whether they are teachers, maybe doctors, other specialists that you had probably been seeing at that time, and at least talking to, kind of having conversations with. And they might be telling you like, oh, it's not that big of a deal, or somehow kind of, not that they're doing it on purpose, but like kind of talking you out of it, or at least making you second guess what's going on. And I think specifically within the healthcare community, when you have some healthcare provider tell you something that differs than how you feel in your heart and in your body, it does make you sit back and like second guess, like, well, maybe it is just me. Maybe it's all in my head. Maybe the pain's not as bad. Maybe I am making a bigger deal out of this. And I've heard that from a lot of people, whether it is trauma, whether it is just some sort of like diagnosis or injury or something like that, where they almost don't accept the full extent of what's going on because a professional has told them something different.
Absolutely. Once that happens, then you're just at that point where it's like, well, okay, I like this idea better, that something's not actually wrong with me, whether it's physical or mental or whatever it is. So I'm going to stick with that because that makes me feel safer, even if that's not reality.
Yeah. So maybe we can take a minute and just talk about some of these definitions about trauma and kind of just like dig deep into what this specifically is, because I think, and I'll be honest for myself, I think before we spoke and before I've kind of dug into some of the literature around this, I had my preconceived notions of what trauma was. And I have really kind of shifted my view as a therapist and as a practitioner over the years. And I think it will be really beneficial to just kind of elaborate and explain, because trauma is, it's not just something that goes into like one little box. Like it literally can look and feel and be different for everybody. So let's kind of just like talk about what it is.
So first of all, trauma is a very, very, very complex subject. And there are many definitions and all kinds of like hierarchies and all kinds of things that I could go into, but I'm going to put it very simply just for a general understanding. So trauma by definition is some perceivingly harmful, dangerous thing that happens. And trauma occurs when someone perceives that it is that way and they don't have the internal or external resources to cope with that. So with that being said, I don't get to say that you being in a car accident isn't traumatic. That for you, you perceived that you were going to die and therefore your brain went into that survival mode and you now are traumatized from that accident. Now, everything that is considered trauma is going to be a little bit different based on the individual. So you'll hear me saying a lot, this may be that. It's because everyone is unique. Everyone's brains are very unique. And even though there's research on what areas of the brain can be impacted and things like that, it's going to differ from person to person. So it's important when you think about trauma that you remember that it's not one size fits all. And really, it comes down to that person's perception of what happened. And then from there, the brain changes. So the best way that I can describe everything is kind of going off of Peter Levine's work. And he talked about trauma in regards to nature in the jungle, right? Like the predator-prey relationship. So I want you guys to picture a gazelle in the grass. They're just frolicking through the grass. No one's around. They're just going on their way. Maybe they're getting their food and they're going to go back to their group. And that's their normal day and that's fine. Now another gazelle goes out and a lion is lurking. And a lion is over there and the lion is ready to pounce. And the gazelle sees the lion, that fight or flight mode and that survival mode starts running and it runs away. And the lion got away. Nothing happens. But that gazelle is now a little bit hesitant and is on guard the next time they go out. But what about that gazelle that went out and was attacked by the lion? Blood everywhere. Barely got away with their life intact. But they got away. How do you think that gazelle is going to feel going out into the wilderness next time versus the one who just saw it and ran? But the other thing is, the more frequent it happens, the more lions that gazelle encounters, the more on guard and ready to fight or run away that gazelle is going to be. So that's kind of like trauma. There are little traumas and big traumas. Some of those they call big T trauma, those serious life impacting events. We're talking about sexual violence, physical abuse, those big things that everyone would be like, oh yeah, that would be traumatic. But little traumas, they call little T trauma, maybe more emotional abuse here or there, maybe bullying at school, maybe it is a car accident, but not a super severe car accident, just something that shakes you a little bit, gets those stress levels going. But what research has found is people seem to think that just these big things are going to be traumatic and going to be life impacting, but a lot of little things over and over can actually be similarly impacting, if not more. And that is something that I think that everyone needs to understand. There may be one little thing that happens, and then all of a sudden you see someone react differently and they go into the survival mode more and their behavior changes and they're startled more often. And you start seeing just changes in their emotional regulation, ability to process, but you don't know about what happened in their life up until that point. You don't know how many lions that gazelle has encountered. So while there are many hierarchies of trauma, like complex trauma, and we talk about developmental and the chronic and then just very acute, that's the best way to explain it for now.
I think two of the things that really stood out to me were It's the person's perception of that trauma. So it's not necessarily like, oh, I think that's a big deal. That's a trauma in your life. It really should be whoever experienced it, whoever went through it, it's how they perceive it. And then I love that analogy that you said, because again, for me, I think originally when I was thinking about trauma, I was thinking about the big T traumas, the big traumatic events that we can see having an impact on people. But I guess I wasn't as keenly aware to these little T traumas, these small things that I say small, I don't even want to say that, but like, I guess less obvious things that could be happening that can have the same, if not greater, impact on an individual, but might not necessarily be perceived by the public, as by society, as a big deal in that one moment, in that one isolated incident. But you just don't know how many of these a person has been dealing with, has been coping with, has been going through, how long they've been going through it. And honestly, I don't even know if that really matters. It could be one small thing that happened that can have an impact on them.
Absolutely. And when you were talking, that got me thinking that, you know, some of those smaller things and some of those smaller traumas that people don't address and don't understand fully, one of those is low income. And when you look into the research, there is a direct correlation with low income and being exposed to trauma. And that's not saying one causes the other, but it's saying there's a relationship there. Whether that's they're in a low income area and they're around more community violence, or, you know, people are doing different things to get ends meet and there's drugs or whatever that may be, but there is a direct relationship there. So the moment I see a kid on a caseload who comes from a low income area, I kind of consider how I'm going to interact with them.
I think that's a good point too, is to not necessarily just think about the event that happened or could happen, but also kind of these things that can be a precursor or have some sort of a relationship or correlation, or these things that put people at risk of experiencing trauma, regardless if it's big or small. And I think another thing too, specifically me being pediatrics, you being in pediatrics, I think a lot of times people don't realize how things can affect younger children. And especially like when they're really, really young, and they might think, oh, well, they're not paying attention that the dad's yelling at the mom, or that the parents are stressed about money, or they think that the kids don't pick up on these things. But even if the kid is not talking and maybe has communication delays or something like that, like, they are still picking up, they're feeding off of that energy and the stress level in the house. And so it's one of those things that regardless of your age and what's going on, like, you can still be exposed to trauma and things that are going on in your lives and perceiving them in the way that your body and your brain is trying to make sense of it.
I would agree. And even back in the NICU, like, people underestimate the impact that, you know, a NICU stay, for instance, can have on someone's development. And it's not only what they were brought to the NICU for, it's the sensory input that's overstimulating constantly. It's maybe they're separated from their parents during that very important bonding time. There's so many things that can happen in the NICU. And there's research that I've read recently that shows links to stays in the NICU to sensory processing challenges. So no matter your age, I mean, and also that kind of reminds me when you were saying, like, whether or not, like, those young kids, you think they understand, anyone who's interacted with a 2-year-old who automatically says a cuss word knows that that's just not the case. Like, you know, like, they're always listening. They're looking at you for how to behave and how to interact in this world. And whether that's positive or negative, they're soaking up everything, including those stress responses. And I, you know, firsthand, I've seen this with my youngest brother. And for those who do not know, my brother had a stroke when he was 18 months old and is cognitively and developmentally delayed. And he's in his 20s now. But to this day, I still see those fear responses and that survival mode. And he almost, like, ticks. Like he will, you never fully know what's going to trigger someone. And I don't think I've even to this day figured out his triggers, but I know that he grew up in the same household that I did. And even if he was not the one who was the quote unquote victim, then he was still around it. And he will, when he gets really upset, sometimes he will like start like shaking, almost like ticking, and his eyes will blink really fast. And he'll just start saying things like, go away, you did it, you ruined it, you over and over and over. And he can't stop. You see him sweating, you see him shaking, and you see the awareness not there. And it breaks my heart because that level of he can't understand. He thinks he did something wrong. And cognitively, he's probably about 5 or 6. And so I think of those younger kids who are experiencing those things and who don't fully understand. And while my brother is older, I think he is at a much lower developmental level. And that just, with my experience with that and trying to help him process through that, it really reminds me what those young minds can really be feeling and doing while processing these stressful things in their lives.
Yeah, I think one of the important things to kind of highlight right now is paying attention to the details, especially when we're talking about kids that we could be working with. The small things that they say, the small things that they do, their body language, their reactions, their anything that you can kind of pick up that they're showing us, that is like going to be the key, the lens into trying to help them through whatever it is that they're going through. And whether it's a big T trauma or a small T trauma, we might not know that specifically in the beginning, but there definitely, and I'm sure you can probably like attest to this growing up, there were things that you were probably doing within your behavior that either you were saying or doing or not doing. And that was you kind of looking for help or trying to see, is somebody out there to help me, and waiting for somebody to kind of like take that and say, oh, I see what's going on. I'm here for you.
Oh, yeah. So some of the things in my own life, I think that I mentioned briefly that, you know, I was a straight A student and I was the teacher's pet. And one of the things that I did is that I tried to make amazing relationship with my teachers. I would try and hang out with the adults and just be part of that crowd. And I didn't really have as much interest in engaging with my peers. I really wanted that adult interaction. I was begging to stay in for recess, and I was offering to stay after school to help them clap their erasers or whatever it may be, just to be seen as helpful and useful. And wow, she's a really good kid. That's what I wanted to hear. That's what I was looking for. You're a really good kid and I care about you. And I look back even in my professional life, all of those kids who were like me. And the moment I see a child, what I call connection seeking, whether that's behavioral, quote unquote, because behavior is communication and it's our job to figure out what they're trying to communicate. So whether it's that kid who's like, I don't care about this, whatever, and is acting out all the time, or it's that kid who's the teacher's pet, there's some change and there's something they're looking for. And I think at that point, it's important to be curious. And it's not to say that when you see those little things that you're going to be like, oh, I'm going to report this, I know what's going on. That's not the case. And many times we may not fully know what's going on, but you can start to interact with them differently. You can start to pay attention to more of the little things.
Yeah, I think a lot of times, specifically as therapists, when we see a kid or a person react, I'll say quote unquote, behaviorally, the automatic assumption is we give this excuse of like, they're lazy, they're unmotivated, they just want to be difficult. And actually, this could even be the kids, but it could be their parents too that we're working with, right? Like, it doesn't necessarily just have to be our clients. It could be the caregivers that might not be listening to what we have to say as professionals. And it is looking beyond the behavior and trying to figure out why they are doing or not doing what is going on. That, I think, is really that key to figure it out. Because I think what you were just kind of saying, like the kids that are just not interested. And they're just like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be working with you. This is stupid. I don't want to do this. Like, oh, this is too young, or this is too easy. Whatever the case may be, I think as a practitioner, I'm just like, gosh, like, why don't they want to be here? This stinks. Like, I'm here. I want to work with them. But there's so much more going on under the surface that we don't know about. And it's almost that like cry for help in a sense of either disengaging or like the over engager that's like, oh, I'm here. Yeah, I'll do that. Oh, yeah, that's great. Oh, this is so much fun. Oh my gosh, isn't this great? Can I do it this way? Are you sure? Can I do it this way? And you're like, whoa. But both of those people are trying to communicate something, even if they don't necessarily know what it is that they're communicating. And even if they're not verbally saying what it is that they want. But I know that we've both worked with clients that have been on both ends of those spectrums, and really recognizing the small details into guiding where you can kind of make that communication and make that connection.
Yeah. And that's not to say too that these behaviors, quote unquote, that are happening are due to trauma. I mean, it could be that the child doesn't feel good at what they're learning. And so instead of asking for help, they're just like, oh, whatever. Or, I mean, it could be that they're having some sensory processing challenges and don't know how to, you know, one, their body is reacting, and two, they don't know how to grasp what's happening to them. So, I mean, there's so many layers of what can be happening. But the main thing is that when you see that change and really that looking for connection, that's really when I think, okay, I'm going to look into this more, and this kid needs more of my support. And I don't think that any of my teachers, definitely in elementary school, saw that in me.
Yeah. It's kind of, I don't know. It's heartbreaking. It's,
yeah.
It's heartbreaking to hear that, because and maybe this is just me being like a healthcare professional, but I want to go back in time and be like, I see you, I hear you. Like, I don't know what's going on. And maybe I've never gone through it myself, but like, I want to change that. Right. And I feel like that's probably a lot of what has kind of fueled you into your professional role and how you are working with clients and how you perceive working with future clients and moving forward is really kind of going off of the experiences that you went through, and now pairing that with all of the literature, all of the research, everything that you have been learning and integrating and becoming more aware of, like what is actually happening and how that impacts a person, and then also what to do about it. Like, yes, knowing that trauma exists, that's great. But like, now what? What are things that we can do as practitioners that can really help with that?
So that brings up a really, really good point. When I was studying trauma in my doctorate program, I kept coming across some similar themes. And I also was thinking about many of the kids that I used to work with. I worked in special education as an instructional assistant for 3.5 years before I went to OT school. And I came across many children who I now look at, and I was actually in a Title I school, so in a very at-risk area, some really hard stories. My dad's in jail. There was a drug bust. That, I mean, just constantly in an area that is at risk. And I'm sure that many of these children have been through things. The thing that I learned is it was through trial and error what really helped connecting with these kids. But it really goes back to, number one, connection. We talk about it as occupational therapy practitioners all the time, that the rapport and the relationship is really important. But with kids who've experienced trauma, it's that much more important. And actually, research shows that one stable, healing adult can make the difference in how this toxic stress or this trauma is processed in this child. That one person who provides that safety, who allows them to process, who believes in them, who doesn't give up, who sees them, can help them with their own resilience. And that's powerful. And while trauma is sad and you go in, I mean, it impacts the brain, like physically changes parts of the brain. We're talking the hippocampus, the amygdala, the prefrontal cortex. You go into all the sciencey stuff. But when it comes down to it, it impacts the person and the way they see the world and the way they function. And as occupational therapy practitioners, we focus on someone's function. So whether that's the child has a hard time paying attention because they're in survival mode, or they didn't get enough sleep last night because of X, we work on sleep or attention interventions. If the child has a hard time with emotional regulation, we work with that. But we do that by making ourselves the most safe and secure adult that we can be for that child. And there's a story back from when I worked in special education. There was this girl and she was in third grade and she classified technically as emotional disability. And at the time, I worked primarily with social emotional groups and I saw this child a lot, probably 3 times a week for actual structured groups. And she also was what we'd call a frequent flyer to the office. I mean, 1 or 2 times a day. And this little girl would have rage fits. You never knew fully what was happening or what was triggering it. And she also came to school dirty and smelled horrible. And her hair was matted. And on those times when she wasn't in that emotional meltdown state, she just wanted love. And I really connected with this girl. And this story to this day still hits me really hard because I see her as me. And it really took me going back to what would I have wanted when I was a child? Because even though I was the teacher's pet and that perfect angel kid at school, I would come home and I was a brat. And even to this day, I'm like, oh my gosh, some of the things I did, it's been really hard to forgive myself and remind myself that I didn't have full control over what I was doing. That me lashing out was something that was a long time coming, that I was constantly on guard, that stress response, that everything in me was always going so fast. And I was just ready to attack or I was ready to run. And sometimes I froze, but emotional regulation was something that I struggled with and that this girl struggled with. There were times when she would get so upset that she would be bawling and she would tell me, I'm seeing white, I don't know where I am, and would just start like completely almost dissociating. And I would sit there and I would squat down and hold her hands and I would say, look at me. Look at me. I'm right here. Just really quietly, really calmly, speaking as slow as I possibly can. I'm like, I'm right here. And she started to calm down a little bit. And then she, you know, as she started to like get back to the present moment, and it was really just trying to ground her. What do you see? How can you know? Like, not too many words, because at that point when someone is so emotional and so overwhelmed, they're not processing that anyways. But I was trying to just as much like squeeze her hands, bring back that awareness, you know, make sure that I was on her level so when she opened her eyes that she felt comfortable with me, far enough away that it wasn't intimidating, but close enough where there was connection. And then we would get to this point and be like, okay, what is something that makes you happy? And she would talk about bunnies. And I was like, okay, so where does this bunny live? She's like, in a green pasture. And I was like, wonderful. Let's close our eyes and let's think about that bunny green pasture. And then we would talk about a little bit more, okay, what's the day like? What's the weather like? And then she would say, it's sunny or it's raining. Okay, what does the bunny need to do now? And what I found with that is not only was that grounding, that was forcing her to think of other things, like visualizing things, that was pulling her out of that trauma processing, because we don't fully know where she was in that point when she was so elevated and really in a panic state, that she wasn't where she should have been. She wasn't in the classroom. Her mind was not in the classroom. Her mind was who knows where else. Her mind might have been where, you know, she was just talking about the other day how her dad came in and shot the ceiling and someone came in and took money and not knowing what that meant. That could have been where her brain was, and who knows what triggered that. But many people, and while everyone was trying to do their best and trying to help her, there was a discipline that happened with, well, you don't do that. And I stopped and said, well, this cycle isn't working. And I know that you guys know this isn't working. And it was me and a few of my colleagues, like, how can we help her? And it got to this point where when she would get to those big meltdowns and have to be taken out of class, they would call me or my other colleague and be like, you're the only one who can get through to her, go. And it was at that point for me that I realized, maybe I have a future in this. Like, I've always wanted to give back to these children. This is before any OT training or any understanding of what trauma fully was. And really, like, it was just an instinct at that point. And it was, what did that inner child in me need? And it worked. Then I started diving into the research when I was in my doctoral program, and I went to an interprofessional trauma conference. And one of the speakers was talking about, you know, how to interact with a child who's experienced trauma. And they said the phrase connection before correction. To me, that was life-changing. And I think that was based off of Bruce Perry's work. It was never really cited. But to me, that's that these kids, especially if you know, like, they have had a harder life, or that you can suspect maybe something has happened. Those kids who grew up in foster care, for instance, that have gone from home to home. You know, we know some of those homes are great, but we know some of the homes, unfortunately, are not. You know, just anything that you can think, okay, maybe this might be something that they may have experienced trauma at some point in their life, or they're just acting a little bit differently. We can go back to that. Let's make ourselves safe. And I've even gone as far as in meltdowns in occupational therapy sessions. This child is overwhelmed. They're testing someone new. And they get to this point where they're so elevated and they aren't fully aware of themselves, which I know many of us have been there many times. And one girl in particular on my caseload was just screaming, you hate me. I hate you. You don't love me. I'm not good at this. And even though they were in this really high emotional state, I just sat there very calmly and said, I care about you. Just that's it. And I don't necessarily condone talking a lot through big emotional meltdowns. Like I said, they're not processing it anyways. And if anything, it's more stimulation. But to me, this girl, it was a cry for help. You hate me. You hate me. It wasn't I hate you. It was you hate me. And at that point, I knew that that child was looking for validation. And so very calmly, just kind of, you know, we got really calm. We got on the floor. We let them cooled down, turned, like they were climbing up walls and climbing on tables and, you know, getting everything out of the room that we could, and had dad watching in the observation room. And afterwards, it was able to be a really positive session. They came back down. We were able to have this really good discussion, and we made a break card and we made a help card. And finally, we were like, uncovered what the problem was. And it came back down to that connection piece, that rapport that I spent with that child, weeks and weeks and weeks it took for that child to trust me. And you know what? I can't say what's happened in her life. That child was adopted. So I don't know what happened. And they were adopted when they're a little bit older too. So I don't know what that child's experienced. But what I can do is, even in those hard moments where they're frustrated and where they are unaware, and really many adults could feel that stress and also get frustrated and show that, I did everything I could, even though I was feeling that stress response, calm exterior, no facial expressions, taking as many deep breaths as I could, modeling what I knew they needed. And it took time, but I also, after the fact, wasn't, now you were bad. It was, let's talk about that. And if that child hadn't been ready to talk about it, I wouldn't have at that time. But after we help them regulate, then we can go back to the reasoning behind it and prepare them for next time. And it all comes down to that relationship that we built. Because it took probably 4 or 5 weeks of this girl testing me and, no, I'm not going to do what you say. Like, just constant defiance on purpose. And then it turned into, whenever I see you, I'm going to give you the biggest hug. Oh, Miss Taylor. And it shows me that even that, I'm not going to do what you say, you can't make me, was looking for that relationship, was looking to be validated. If I could tell any occupational therapy professional or student what to do, especially with this population, but it just in general with your clients, build that true connection. Care about them unconditionally. That's even when they're throwing things at your head, that they know that you still care about them.
I think that connection piece, that part of our job, our role as an occupational therapy provider, is one of, if not the most important part of what we can do as a healthcare professional. And I think so often we, as therapists, as providers, we get stuck on the goals because of our funding sources, because of our job, because of our boss. We're supposed to be working on visual motor. We're supposed to be working on dressing. We're supposed to be working on whatever it is. And so when our client is so dysregulated, we're like, what are we supposed to do? We need to be working on this goal. We have to get back there. And we lose that connection piece of like, we have to get to that goal because that's what we're dictated. That's what we need to work on. But if our client is not even in a place, if they're not even with you, right? Like, I love what you said, that girl could have just been somewhere else, even though physically she was with you, mentally her brain was going through something else. And you can't address our long-term goals when they're not even there. And you have to build that connection. You have to get them to calm down. You have to bring them back and really connect with them in order to do it. Because we all know that specifically people that will have a large behavioral outburst, the first thing that other people do to them is try to correct them. They try to point out what you're doing is wrong. They try to point out that this is not how we act. You need to try harder. You need to do better. You need to do this. You need to stop what you're doing. And they might not even at that point, might not know that what they're doing is wrong. When they're calm, they can look back and say, yeah, I know exactly what I did was wrong, but they weren't even there. They weren't even in their body. And I loved how you just kind of highlighted the breath. You highlighted the deep pressure, the squeezes to the hands, or maybe it was like a whole body pressure, arms, legs, whatever it is. We almost have to talk to the bodies at a cellular level and not at a cognition level. You have to get the body to learn to organize and to calm before you can even attempt to go anywhere else within the treatment session or treatment sessions, depending if this kind of goes longer than just one. But it really is kind of reshaping. It's redefining, not just using typical modalities that we would try to use to address these things with our clients. It's really going above and beyond, slowing down, getting on their level, and connecting with them. Because that connection, that relationship, it will be the foundation of everything else moving forward.
Yeah. And, you know, when you're talking about goals, how can we expect a child to work on their goals when they're not feeling safe? You know, we look at the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and first is that basic safety, right? That food, that shelter. And then we go up a little bit, and then it's those social emotional needs. And then we start getting to that point where, okay, maybe I can start doing things for myself. But if learning is way towards the top, and these kids have holes at the bottom of the pyramid, how can we expect them to be able to learn and to achieve these goals and actually conceptualize those skills that we're working on right now, like to internalize what's happening and be able to be like, okay, and it's not just this rote habitual thing that we're, you know, like, oh no. So eventually, like, you know, when we're handwriting or any of those things that are really repetitive, that eventually motor memory is going to kick in. But that's not the best way to learn. And we know as occupational therapists that like play and movement and sensory and all of those things help with learning. And that takes a lot of engagement. So if that child isn't engaged, and even in my documentation, I will justify rapport building in order to access this, in order to then reach this goal, because it is that important. And like you said, like, we're not going to get where we need to go if we don't have that relationship. And once you have that relationship, I can think back on so many stories that it took a while, but the moment we had that relationship, they soared either academically or in their goals or whatever it may be. The moment they felt safe, safe to fail, safe to be able to ask questions, safe to say, hey, I don't know, safe to feel their emotions and break down and know that you are still going to be there for them, then they start feeling more courageous. Then they start believing more in themselves. And especially in people who've experienced trauma, self-worth and self-esteem and even self-concept, like who you are as a person, is actually impacted. So some of these people don't even know who they are. And I can attest to that. I didn't even know who I was. Like I said, I identified myself with my achievements. And I'm 27 now. And it took me until maybe like 25, 26 to fully realize who I was. And I was in counseling. I've been through years and years and years of counseling, which is necessary. And I was always like, okay, when am I going to get back to this, you know, when am I going to get back to normal? When am I going to feel like myself again? And they told me like, you're not going to get back to that ever again, but you're going to find that new normal. And then they're like, who are you? And I was like, oh, well, I am a straight A student. I am, you know, I'm known for this. I do all of these good things for these people. I'm a sister. I'm a daughter. I'm, you know, like, and I started listing all these things who I am to everyone else. She stopped me and she goes, okay, you realize that everything that you just said was related to how someone else saw you. How do you see yourself? And I sat there and I didn't have an answer. And it was that emotional abuse and that being constantly told that I was fat or ugly or worthless or never going to work with special needs children, which has been my dream since I was 12 years old, that I was mentally unstable, that I was an awful, awful person, that I was dramatic or horrible or any of the list of things. I couldn't think of one thing over a decade later that was me. That wasn't attributed to someone else. That was something that I was proud of. Now, all those things started coming in my head. I was like, well, I'm a dramatic person and I'm all of these things, which dramatic is just code for, I don't know how to categorize you and you're a strong person, which I've learned. Hey, yo. I don't know. Like that was the one thing, like going back to, oh, you're dramatic. Oh, you're just too dramatic. And I was just downplaying everything that happened to me. And so my emotional responses were invalid because I'm just a dramatic person. And even to this day, like, there are some members of my family or friends who still, like they knew me then and they see when I have those emotions, they're like, oh, well, there's just that dramatic Taylor side again. And I'm like, it's not that. I mean, yeah, I am an emotional person and I am a very passionate person, but that phrase is just completely just denying anything that ever happened to me and saying that my emotions are invalid. And, you know, when we categorize these kids, like they're the bad kids or, you know, they're the ones who they're just always hyper or, you know,
they're the
biters. Exactly. When we start categorizing these kids, we lose who they are. And I'm guilty of it. I've done it before and I've had to check myself and it's a really hard thing to do. And I have, you know, when I was working in special education, I'm talking to teachers, they're like, oh, you have that kid? Good luck.
Yeah. I've heard that so many times.
Like when we go in with that mindset, do you really think that you're going to be able to help that child? We have to care about them unconditionally. We have to know that these things that they're doing, these big cries for help, they're outside of their control. Either that or they really are asking for your help. And you're doing the opposite. You're pushing them away before you've even stepped foot in the classroom with them. Everything about trauma-informed care, it's a mindset. And you're never fully going to be informed. And I actually don't love saying trauma-informed, though that's what's widely accepted. I say trauma-sensitive. I say that because you're never going to reach that peak where you're like, oh yeah, I know everything about trauma. Because guess what? Humans change. Mm-hmm. Humans are as unique as trauma is. And if we go back to trauma as a perception, you may understand what some potential side effects might be. You might see like some red flags, some big signs. but you don't understand trauma. Just like to this day, we still don't understand the brain. We know parts. We know some things. We have a lot of hypotheses, a lot of theories, and a lot of things that have been proven true over and over again. But our brains are so unique. Do we really know everything about the brain?
No, definitely not. Exactly. And things are going to change. We're going to get more technology, more research, and we're going to be like, whoa, how did we not know this beforehand? Yeah. But think back 20 years ago, think back 50 years ago, think back 100 years ago. Like, think of the amount of information that we now know, and we're continuing to learn. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So I think you kind of alluded to this earlier, and I keep kind of reflecting on it while we've been talking throughout this whole conversation. But I think we've been focused a lot on how we're perceiving our clients, how we're perceiving the people that we're working with. Mm-hmm. But I also kind of want to bring to the forefront of our own selves, our own therapeutic use of self, and what we are experiencing, and then what we bring to the table, good and bad, right? We all have things that we are strong with in terms of being a professional and what we can offer, but we are all dealing with our own sets of maybe trauma, maybe just experiences, things that we have gone through and things that we're currently going through. And how can we as therapists who go in, we work with clients day in and day out that potentially have their own trauma, they have their own stories that pull at our heartstrings, but we also have our own lives outside of that. How do we bridge the gap of understanding our own unique experience, our own unique stories, but then also being able to be there for our clients that are also going through or have gone through very difficult situations?
Everyone go to counseling. No, I mean, there's a lot more to it, right? So you brought up a really good point, because what you're talking about when we are interacting frequently with those people with those hard stories, whether that's the medical traumas in the spinal cord injury unit or working with kids in a classroom, we are constantly seeing people go through trauma. And I'd like to think that a majority of our caseload is full of people who might have experienced trauma, because I can consider medical trauma as something that is also very serious and can be very traumatizing to humans. Mm-hmm. So when I want to think about that, I know that, okay, so a lot of people on my caseload are talking about their stories and their hard things. And maybe some of those hit me harder because I've been through it. Like you said, you know, we have our own biases that we always have to keep in check. And really, it comes down to us being so aware of ourselves and knowing when we can be there for that person, and also knowing that we can't be on that person's caseload. I know personally that I still have some work to do. And I've learned that some of the children that I come into contact with really trigger me. Right now, I know that I am not in a spot where I can interact with kids with these hard stories on a daily basis. As much as I want to work with trauma, I know that that's too close to me right now with where I am in my healing process, because healing will never be linear. You will always be peeling off layers. But what I can do is work with the providers and work with the teachers and help them understand. But when we look at the numbers, 1 in 4 people, by the time they're 18, will have experienced 2 or more of these big traumas, and that can start to impact their development. Now, about 50% of humans will experience a big trauma in their lives. And that's not to say that they're going to have the same impacts and it's going to affect them forever, but something big. So when you look at that, when as an adult provider, there's going to be potentially a lot of things that could be triggering. And we have to know, one, like, you have to do your own work. And I think that's one of the biggest pushbacks of trauma-informed care and being trauma-sensitive is you have to know yourself. You have to dive deep into those parts that you never wanted to look into. And that's scary, because when most of us grew up, trauma wasn't a thing. We didn't talk about mental health. We didn't talk about our problems as much. And so we're getting into this new generation where it's important to understand ourselves and what we're experiencing and what we have experienced. And we really focus on mental health. And so whether or not you go to a counselor or you just have someone to process with, get it out. Really, like, keeping it inside. To me, I think of the analogy, I don't know if anyone's seen Heroes, but on season one, it's like the superhero show kind of. And there's this guy who has this power and he soaks up everyone else's powers. And spoiler alert, sorry if you've never seen it, but there's a scene where he goes up into the sky. One of his is flying and he has all these powers inside and he's almost like electric. Like he's like ready to explode, totally ready to explode. He has all this stuff and he doesn't know what to do with it. And then it just, and that's the way I think about it. That if we keep everything inside and we just keep pushing it down, acting like it's not there, eventually it's still there. But little things are going to come on and then there's going to be more and more and more. And eventually it's just going to explode out of control. And I've had many explosions in my life. I soak up emotions like a sponge. And, you know, we're more prone to it when we're in the midst of big stressful things, for sure. But when we don't deal with our own emotions, then we put ourselves at risk for being unprofessional, for not behaving the way that we know we need to, for losing that control. And you really just, you have to process, you have to deal with it. In that moment when it's hard, if that's step out, grab the adult next to you and say, hey, I just got to take a break real fast. You know yourself. You know when you need to step away. You know that the moment that you lose your cool in front of these kids, their trust plummets, and that's a hard responsibility. You have to know yourself. It's hard work.
It's so, yeah. I think that self-awareness is one of those skills that's just like the hardest thing. And I think it's also just like a constant learning process for all of us. Because again, just like we were talking about the brain, like we are constantly learning. We are constantly getting exposed, going through different experiences that are ultimately going to affect how we are moving forward, how we mm-hmm. are as we age and we get older. And I think there's two things right there. It is understanding when we ourselves need resources and we need to do some work on ourselves and either talk to somebody or participate in some self-care where we need to go do something for ourselves. But also when we're working with clients, we need to realize when we need to refer to outside resources as well. I think one of the amazing things that we as occupational therapy providers possess is this ability, this passion, this desire to want to work with anybody and everybody. And we can connect with people. And that means that we take on so much of who they are, especially a lot of the bad, the negative, the kind of icky stuff. We are so good at absorbing that and helping our clients work through it. But when you step back and reflect on that for a second, if we are every 30 minutes, every hour of our typical 40-hour work week or whatever it is, like think about how many things that we are absorbing, how much negativity, how much hardship that we are bringing into our own selves out of our own passion, our own desire to do it. But then we're internalizing that. And so it's really having that self-awareness within ourselves, but then also realizing the power of relying on other people to either support you with that case or to support you as a practitioner.
Totally agree. One thing that I think we can also do is knowing what experiences we have been through. And one thing that's really good to sum that up is if anyone has heard of adverse childhood experiences or ACEs, it's a groundbreaking study that was done, I believe, in the 90s by Kaiser Permanente. And they essentially found this relationship with stressful events and functioning and health. It led to the more increased big events that you have, or they call ACEs, by the time you're 18, the more it can predict functional outcomes and your health. So we're talking about the risk of cancer. The people who have had four or more experiences by the time they're 18 have huge risks for cancer, autoimmune diseases. And we know that toxic stress, we're talking about sensory processing, emotional regulation challenges. There are just a lot of things that you wouldn't necessarily consider. And I'm like, cancer? What do you mean cancer? When I first read that, I was like, no way. But it actually makes sense when your body is in that constant state of stress hormones, all of these negative hormones constantly. And you're just like, your body is like always ready to fight off something. Why wouldn't something later in life that's so harmful develop? I have an autoimmune disease, and there is no one in my family that has anything. You know, I'm like, I don't have any of the risk factors. I'm seemingly healthy, and I went through a really severe trauma when I was 22 that I think just set it off, that I actually developed PTSD, and it was really, really bad, and it really impacted my functioning for a long time. And then a year later, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. So there's so many functional impacts, but one thing that we can look at in our clients and in ourselves is an ACEs screening tool. Essentially, it's just looking at your ACEs score, they say. And if you know your ACEs score, you can be a little bit more equipped for what your function and what some things might be. And mine is actually a 7. So if that tells you anything, like, I have had to fight really hard, even as an adult, to function and to maintain that level of balance more than maybe some others who hadn't had that. And when we know where we lie, we know how susceptible we are to potential stressful experiences. And that's not to say that, you know, the ACEs screener, obviously it's just until you're 18, but I think it's important to reflect on the things that you've been through and, you know, what bothers you? What are some things that bother you as a person? For instance, I can't stand people who act like they are better than anyone. Like, they are just like, I rule. And that's because I grew up with a narcissist. And I look at that now, but to me, it ignites this fire in me that I'm just like, oh no, my mama bear comes out. And I know that when I'm around someone like that, that I need to take some extra beats before I interact. Because one of my favorite things that I learned from a friend long ago, she had this saying, and she said, when emotions are high, intelligence is low. Mm-hmm. And I have lived by that saying ever since. And when we start having these emotional reactions towards whatever is going on, we really have to know, okay, one, what could trigger it, and be on the lookout for yourself and notice those signs. And two, to be able to know when to step away. So we have to reflect on our biases constantly. And that's a hard thing to ask of people.
Throughout this entire conversation, certain cases, certain kids keep popping up in my head. And I'm like, there was so much more than I didn't see, that mm-hmm. I attributed to something else that I thought was sensory, that I thought was just emotional dysregulation, that I put in my own, say, diagnosis or my own label on the situation. Even if it wasn't like an official diagnosis, just me, that's how I like interpreted the situation. And yeah, I've just like this entire time, I've just been reflecting on different kids, and they've all presented differently. They've all had different reactions, different behaviors, different, it's just everything. Everything's different across the board. But I'm just sitting there like, I think talking about trauma and going back to what you said about trauma-informed versus trauma-sensitive, I think that's a great way of putting it, because it's almost like when we're talking about like cultural competency, and I've always hesitated with that competency part, because it's not that we could just get to this level and say, oh, we're good. Like, we're competent in cultural, we're competent in trauma. Like, that doesn't really make sense. It's kind of this ever changing and this fluid entity that's happening. And so being sensitive, being aware to trauma or potential trauma, you might not even know about it. I think that's the real, like, important part to hone in on and really highlight in this conversation. And I know, like, we've said a lot and that we've talked about a lot of things so far, but if you had just like one tip, one piece of advice 4 other occupational therapy providers right now in regards to trauma, but they may or may not know that their client is going through it, or maybe the family's going through it. What would be that one thing that you hope that somebody that's listening to this might be able to take away from this conversation?
I would say relationship always comes first. You will have these external pressures to meet this goal or to follow through on what this teacher said, or, you know, the staff or in the clinic or whatever it may be. There will always be these external pressures. But what research has shown and what we know is the relationship makes the difference. The relationship can physically change the brain back to before it was damaged. And that's not to say it's going to fix everything magically. It's saying the brain is plastic, right? It's changeable. So even though there might have been damage done, we can help children build resilience in anything they may conquer by having that safe relationship. And even if nothing has happened, with that positive relationship and that trust, if anything ever were to happen, who do you think that child is going to come to? The person who knows that without judgment, you're going to accept them for who they are, and you believe in them and you see them for who they can be. It's so easy to lose sight of that, especially in the medical world. And I really want to highlight a documentary. It was done, I believe, in like 2013. It's called Paper Tigers. And it's about this high school that's in Walla Walla, Washington, that's an alternative high school. And what they did is they started changing the way they approached behaviors and challenges in the classroom. They changed going from a behavioral discipline approach to a let's talk about this. Instead of out of school suspensions, let's keep you in school and let's support you. They looked at why things were happening instead of what they were doing. And by just that shift, they found changes in graduation rates, in attendance, in grades, in fights and suspensions. All of those things improved significantly. I mean, these are these kids that were kicked out of other schools, people unable to handle them. And it was a really interesting documentary because it went into their lives and you saw what was behind closed doors, what you wouldn't have seen. It was especially interesting because every student reacted differently. Some were numb. Some were over the top and violent. Some were emotional and looking for that extra attention, engaging in risky behaviors. But they all had one thing in common. They were not able to access their education at the school that they were at, and they were kicked out. And if a school like that can turn it around, if just by caring, if just by changing the way they look at how they discipline people, that they go from you're bad, this is the consequence, to hey, what's going on? How can I help you? That is the key. And you may think it's simple, but it's actually really hard, but it's so important. And regardless of anything else today, remember that we came into this profession because we want to help people. And we lose sight of that the more productivity pressure is put on us. I mean, I could go on a soapbox about this for days, which I'm not going to. But it's so easy to lose sight of human-to-human connection. And the research is telling us, no, we need to get back to that.
So there's a quote that the entire time you were just talking, I was like, this quote is this, like, when I heard this quote years ago, it stood out to me. And I think it is so pertinent to what we've been talking about today. And it's something along the lines of, to the world, you might just be one person, but to one person, you can be the world. And I think a lot of times we as practitioners, we can sense that so much needs to be done outside of just our traditional role of if we're working in peds, if we're working in acute care, if we're working in mental health. We see that there's a systemic problem. There's all these grander issues that we have to fix. And you almost kind of become numb and you're just like, well, there's no way that I can change the world. So I'm just going to give up. But rather than just give up, realize that what we can do on our level, in our day-to-day routines with our clients, with one client, it doesn't even have to be all of them. If we can help one client, there's going to be a ripple effect into their families, into their lives, into their potential future children's lives, and so on. And so really just trying to get out of, we might not be able to fix everything, but if we can focus on just one person and helping them, that can have a grand effect and influence across the board.
Yeah, 100,000%. Like that quote is very powerful, that you know, you don't fully know the impact that you can have on someone, but what we can do is give that person, whether it's the family or the child or the adult that we're working with, we can give them our attention and our care in that moment. And just that little extra 2 minutes at the end of the session or whatever it may be can actually make a huge difference, not only in the relationship we create, in what they're going through.
100%. That's yes. Yes. I am at a loss for words because yes, that's exactly the mentality that I think that we all need to have. And I know there is still so much more that needs to be talked about within trauma and with this subject. And we have barely just scratched the surface in what we've talked about today. This could last days and weeks and months on end. So if people want to connect with you, they want to learn more about what you're up to, they maybe want to see some of these resources that you have, like how can people get in contact with you?
So I'm actually going to be offering a free resource, a little overview of what trauma is, just a nice little infographic. You know, I like the design aspect of things, and I think that visuals are how people learn a lot. So just to sum it up, you can join my email list, which I will link for Sarah. And if once you sign up, you'll get this freebie. And that's a start. And then also I am pretty prevalent on social media. I'm very active on Instagram under TaylorMade OT. And I talk a lot about, you know, occupational therapy and those things that I'm passionate about. And one of those things that I'm going to start talking a whole lot more about is trauma, because I do believe it's my life's purpose. And it's important for us to give back the knowledge that we know. And I think this community needs it more now than ever. So I'm doing what I can to design resources and anything that I can do to support providers in this time, because now more than ever, with the way our community is right now, every single person has the potential to go through trauma right now. So we really need to understand what this is, what could potentially happen, and how people react, and how we can help them get through it. So that's a lot what I'll be talking about on TaylorMade OT. That's the main way you can stay in contact with me.
All right. Final question.
Mm-hmm.
One word to describe occupational therapy, what would it be?
I would say that word is light. To me, in occupational therapy, we have the power to be the light in the potential darkness, to be that one bright light that's taking people and saying, this is where you need to go. I can help you. I can get you back to a point where you feel comfortable, where you feel happy, where you're engaged and it's meaningful. We are that light.
I love it. I feel like that has literally just made our entire conversation come full circle, because we started talking about a light and we're ending with a light. And I got chills. Like, yep, I definitely got chills with that. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming on the show and opening up about your story, because I know that this is not and was not easy for you to do. And I think this just ties into that self-awareness, a lot of that kind of self-talk that we were talking about. And I also appreciate your honesty in saying that you still have work to do, because we all do. We all have processing. We all have to go through life and just keep going and keep plugging away and just keep processing and trying to understand and really do the best work that we can do for our clients. So thank you so much for coming on and discussing this really important topic with me today.
And thank you for allowing me to and feeling safe enough, like creating that safe space for every single person who comes on here. It makes the difference. And I really thank you for having a platform like this, one, and two, being that safe person for so many. You're already doing what I talked about today. And I'm so grateful to know you and to work with you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you like what you hear, here are three easy ways you can help support the show. One, head over to otforlife.com to find out more about any resources discussed on the show. Remember, that's OT4LYFE.com. Two, share the podcast with a friend, colleague, or anyone interested in occupational therapy. Three, subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast player so you don't miss out on any upcoming episodes. And while you're there, be sure to leave a review saying how much you love the show. Thanks again. I'll catch you next time, OT for Lifers. Oh, gosh. And then I see I'm like the first one to mess everything up too. So hold on.
Okay.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Ready? This is like over a year in the making, dude.
Don't put that pressure on. Do not put that pressure on.
No, it's not pressure. It's not pressure at all. Hey, Taylor, how are you?
Good. How are you, Sarah? I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited.
Do it again.
Sure. We can do it again. Oh, my gosh.
I'm not going to talk over you.
No, it's okay. But we can do it again because that will be a funny blooper.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Crap, I forgot what I was going to say.
That's okay.
I knew this was going to happen. Okay, I remember.
Sorry I talked too much. Totally did. It's really easy to get on tangents.
Maybe I wasn't going to ask you, but I was like, oh, we need to talk about that. And then you started, like you brought it in. I was like, yes. Okay.
Connected.
So, yeah.
Got you.
Yeah.
I was worried of that too. I was like, check your words, Tay. Check your words. Like the whole time I was like, don't say the wrong thing. Don't say the wrong thing. Don't say the wrong thing.
There is very little editing that I have to do.
I had like two words. I said twice. That's so huge for me. I was like, let the guardian angels speak through me because there's no way that Taylor is going to totally. Also, I did not plan that light thing. When you said it was like started with light and ended with light, I was like, oh, I guess it did.
Yeah. As soon as you said that, I was like, what the hell? I was like that. In my mind, I'm like, she's going to say connection. She's going to say connection. She's going to say relationship. Like that's where I thought your brain was going to go. And then you said light. And I was like, full circle.
I'm surprised. I didn't catch that at all. I'm surprised you caught that. I was like, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm good. Not even know I'm good. I am safe. I am protected. I pray that the message will come through the way that it's supposed to, and that I will continue to be safe and present and be able to share this important message to everyone and know that I'm not in harm's way right now. And this is just revisiting the past. Okay, I'm good.